difficult emotions, what some people might point to as saying, well, that's suffering. That's the suffering that we are hoping to relieve ourselves of, yes? And why we come to the spiritual path partly is to see if there's a different way of relating to our strong emotions, our emotional stress, ongoing patterns of emotional response that cause us, that are afflictive, that cause us difficulty. So I wanted to reflect on that tonight and offer some practices and perspectives on this topic. This is really kind of like a minimum of a three-part series that I'm going to squish into one class tonight, but I'll try to hit the high points as best I can, offer you some information that I hope will be helpful. So is anybody here at Seattle Insight for the first time today? Oh, wonderful. Welcome. Welcome. It's so great to see new folks. I wouldn't know. It's my first time here too. I'm here for the first time. Is anyone meditating for the first time today? Practicing meditation for the first time? Yes? Okay, good to know. Okay, so in this particular tradition that we practice in here, which comes from Southeast Asia, there's basically three different classes or forms of meditation that I'm going to hopefully touch on. Either we'll practice them, each of them together, or I'll at least talk about them. And one is the tranquility practices, sometimes called concentration practices, or calming practices, called samatha is the fancy word for them, the Pali word for them. Pali, the language that the Buddha, we believe, taught in. And so these practices help us to return our attention to the present in such a way that we, what's called, calm the formations, calm the agitated mind, the mind that may be agitated in an emotional response. And those are going to be the types of practices that are familiar to many of you, where we just pay attention to something simple in the here and now, something neutral like the sensations of our breathing. And they happen to be, there are certain what we call objects of attention that we can pay attention to that are more, that are really, really function to calm us. And I like to begin a class on emotional regulation, or working mindfully with strong emotions, by offering some suggestions for how to practice in a way that is self-soothing. Because this can be our like initial response when we are what's called activated. And by the way, I'm apologizing in advance right now to any psychologists or therapists that are in the audience, because I'm going to be throwing around some terms like emotional activation or emotional regulation and dysregulation that come from the psychological literature. And I don't know a ton about, but I know enough about to use the words in a way that hopefully is appropriate and accurate. I'm sure you'll tell me after, if not. So we can bring these type, one of our, the calming or practices we can use to bring ourselves back to sort of nominal level of regulation by just returning our attention to the here and now. It's kind of magical how it works, actually, but it's not really. There's an explanation for it. It's like as we repeatedly just disentangle our attention from where it's caught up when we're emotionally activated, which is usually in the storyline that is associated with the emotion, like, I can't believe that guy did that to me, oh, why, I yada, you know, whatever. The story, oh my gosh, what if I lose my job? How will I make ends meet? oh, my boss is so awful to me, or my partner, don't they know I don't like them to put that thing there? You know, the stories, the narratives that are associated with the emotion. Hi, Lindell. I just saw you. Hi, nice to see you. With the soothing practices, the calming practices, we're repeatedly disentangling from whatever that storyline is, being lost in the thoughts, being lost in the story, reliving whatever it is that happened that disturbed us over and over and over, and seeing it like a movie in our minds and being lost in the movie. Instead of that, we're coming back to something happening in the present time, our present time experience, that is neutral, more neutral, that doesn't drive the emotions, that is not linked to the emotions, like, for example, the sensations of breathing in our body. And when we just diligently do this repeatedly return our attention to the here and now, to our breath or some other neutralizing object, it works to calm us down. It just does. As I'll get into a little bit later, this points directly to learning about the way that emotions work in our body-mind system. They actually depend on these stories to run. The stories and believing in the stories and being lost in the stories is the engine that drives them. So it makes sense that if we unplug the engine that drives them by extricating our attention from those stories, that the emotions will die down and we'll get calm. So self-soothing, having a suite, if you will, of self-soothing practices is kind of like the first line of defense when it comes to working with difficult emotions, dealing with stuff in your life that goes awry, as it will, and how when you feel overwhelmed by the natural response of things going awry, somebody being mean to you, something going wrong, getting in a car accident, losing your job, someone close to you dies, you get a horrible diagnosis, whatever. Stuff happens, the life stuff. So we can actually use these self-soothing practices to help bring us back to a bit more calmness rather than spin out into the activation. So I thought I would start with that, with about a 10 or 15 minute practice of just a simple returning the attention to the here and now. And I will offer and suggest two or three different objects of experience that we might use. And you see for yourself, everyone is different, but as you switch off between these different objects, paying attention to them, see what the effect is on your mind-body. Is it relaxing, anxiety-producing? Is it hard to pay attention to that object, easy to pay attention to that object? So in this way, by observing our own experience, we find out how they work for us. When I use the word, for those who are new to the practice, when I use the word object, I mean just what we're paying attention to. So we have awareness or attention in the here and now that's observing our experience right now. And then we have what it's seeing, the object. I'm going to suggest three different objects during the course of this 10 or 15 minutes. So just try them out and see how it goes for you. And then I'll talk a little bit more, and then we'll do another kind of practice later. So we will get more practice time in today. Okay, so I invite you to take a posture that will support alertness with a nice elevated spine, but without too much tightness or gripping. I like to use the words strong back, soft front. as a description of a good kind of posture to find to support meditation. Maybe imagining like a string coming out the top of your head and just gently, effortlessly elevating your spine, allowing your chin to dip slightly, which also helps to keep your spine straight and elevated. And then bring your attention to your here and now experience. To begin, I'd like to invite you to turn your attention to your body, the sensations in your body as you sit on the chair or the cushion. Noticing the weight of your body, the pressure where your body touches the cushion, the chair. The sensations of your clothing on your skin. Your feet touching the ground, your hands on your legs, in your lap, or touching each other. So for the beginning, I'm going to invite you to use body sensations as your anchor of attention, which means that when you recognize that your attention has drifted off into thoughts, which it will, and we all should expect that to happen multiple times, when you recognize your attention has strayed, gotten lost, spaced out, whatever, then you simply let go of the thought that's captured you and return your attention back to your body, some sensations in your body. And to begin with, I'm going to invite you to pay attention to, like, sort of scan your attention through your body, noticing if there are any places of gripping, holding, or tension. And if you should come up against any tension, to suggest to that place in your body to relax, to soften, and see what happens. Letting your shoulders drop. Relaxing your throat, neck, back of the neck, if there's tension there. And I like to use a nice out breath. I like to use my exhales to sort of breathe into the place that may be holding tension. As I suggest to myself to let go of the gripping. And if there is any tension or gripping in your belly, see what you can do to soften that. I find it helpful to suggest or ask my body to soften. might it be like to release this kind of habitual gripping that I have in my belly? Breathing into that place, softening. Where else are you feeling tension? How are your hands and feet? How is your face? The jaw, tongue. How about the eyes and eye area, the eye muscles, the brow? I'm naming some places where I tend to hold tension. And so the object that we're using now, the object of attention, is any places in our body where we feel tension or holding. And we're seeing what we can do to soften those. You might have to return to some of the places you've already sent some softening, relaxing energy to, because they might start gripping again. And this is totally normal. As you are being mindful of your body sensations, I invite you to see if you can feel or locate the sensations of breathing in your body. Noticing all the different places in your body that are involved with the breathing, the in-breath, out-breath cycle. some places where I feel breathing happening are my belly, lifting, releasing. And my rib cage, chest area, expanding, stretching, and letting go, contracting. I feel the sensations of air moving through my throat, upper chest. And the air, the cool air coming into my nostrils, tingling, the warm air leaving. And I feel breathing in my back, many different places. Where do you feel it? And of all these places where you feel the breath coming, going, that are involved with breathing, which feels good, pleasant, or at least neutral, not bad, painful? Where does the breathing feel good in your body? Just let your attention go there without thinking about it too much. And this place will be your new object for a couple of minutes. Your new anchor, so whenever you wake up from being lost in thinking, which will happen, has been happening, I'm sure, this is where you return your attention now. So you are connecting with present time experience through these sensations of breathing. Where the breathing feels good in your body. Is it possible to cultivate a receptive and allowing attention? Allowing your breath to be just as it is without interfering with it, whether it's shallow or deep or short or long. Feeling the breathing happening in your body. Receiving these sensations as they change moment by moment. And finally, I'll suggest that we experiment with a new object. You can stay with your breath if that feels good to you and you'd rather steady your attention on your breath. For those who'd like to experiment, I invite you to shift your attention now to sound. Notice how easy it is to just shift objects. Hearing the sounds in this moment. Maybe noticing that your energy goes up in your head. But see if you can listen, hear, recognize sounds without tension coming into your face or head. Again, seeing if you can receive sound. Perhaps noticing the strong, loud sounds first. And as you continue to pay attention to sound, maybe some of the subtler sounds from the background start to emerge. So now as you, when there are times when your attention wanders into thinking, when you wake up from that and remember to be aware in the present, then you can return your attention to sound. Is it possible to be interested in sound, interested in the soundscape? Listening to it almost like music, all the different sounds coming, going, blending with each other, changing. Coming to the end of this practice period, take a moment to notice your mind and body right now. Is it any different than when you began practice? And if so, notice the difference. Offer yourself gratitude for the effort you put into this practice, experimenting with different objects of awareness. Thank you for your practice. So let's see. How many people felt like the body sensations, in particular, intentionally softening or relaxing places of tension, was the most soothing object? How many people felt the breathing sensations and finding a place in your body where the breath felt good, where the breathing felt good, and resting your attention there was the most soothing object? Breath. And how many preferred sound as the most soothing object? See how different? Everyone has a different response to different objects of awareness. And so it's great to experiment with different ones and see how you respond. And that's how you develop your custom-made toolkit, if you will, for meditation. So you might experiment with taking a mindful pause the next time that you are pissed off in traffic, or you lose your keys, or I don't know, something unlucky happens, or someone speaks to you or looks at you in a way that upsets you, to recognize that there's a difficult emotion happening, and then experiment with bringing one of these self-soothing practices in that moment. Just in a moment, can you connect with your breath? Can you just open to sound for a moment? Maybe you have to take about 5 minutes and practice in this way. Get yourself a little bit calmer, and then go on from there. And I did mention at the beginning that there were three different kinds of basic classes or types of meditation that we do in this tradition. And so this is returning our attention to a single object over and over, tranquility or concentration practice is one of those. It helps to steady and calm the mind and from its normal state of agitation and being lost in the mental world. And then that calm state of mind or calmer state of mind is not an end in itself. We then take that relative stability of attention in the here and now, and we turn it toward our mind-body experience in another type of practice, which is called vipassana or insight meditation. And this is where we are observing our mind and body process, moment after moment, and learning about it, and specifically learning about where is the suffering, difficulty, what's the problematic part of our experience, what is it made of, noticing, becoming conscious of these experiences rather than ignoring them. And then also noticing the peaceful or freedom, the moments that are free of difficulty and suffering, which we kind of tend to forget that we have a lot of those all day long. So we're turning our mindful attention to our actual mind-body process. We're watching our minds responding to stimuli moment by moment. And in this way, we understand our minds and we understand how suffering comes to be. And through that understanding, we get creative ideas for how to respond based on what we are seeing. And so this is a way, another way to work with difficult emotions when they arise. We can use a soothing practice to stabilize ourselves if we feel overwhelmed by the emotion, and then we can use the vipassana or investigative mindfulness practice to understand the nature of our emotions, understand their nature, what exactly they are. And I'll come back to this in a minute. And then the third category of practice is a set of practices we call the heart practices that are actually cultivating positive emotional mind states. So we're turning our mind stream towards the positive, towards the beneficial, towards mind states like kindness, self-care, compassion, appreciation, and equanimity, that state of mind where we are calm. And so you see how they sort of inform each other. Sometimes concentration practices, you know, the heart practices are a form of concentration tranquility practice. They can help us calm. And we probably won't get to that kind of practice today in the time we have, but they really are super useful when working with difficult emotions. We can actually use like metta practice, compassion practice, forgiveness practice, appreciation practice to get, you know, stop being overwhelmed by the difficult, afflictive emotion and open up the possibility of some other kind of experience. Just as a for instance, I like to practice with the very simple thing where when I'm feeling, you know, yuck, when I'm feeling stressed out, angsty, or especially when I'm feeling like states of sadness, grief, loneliness, despair, the sort of poverty mind where it's, this isn't good enough, my life isn't good enough, everything sucks, those kinds of mind states. I just intentionally, when I recognize that I'm in that heavy, contracted state of difficulty and stress, I just intentionally turn my mind to, like, I will write out, if I have time, I'll write up a list of everything I'm grateful for in my life, everything I appreciate, or I might just in that moment think of three things I'm grateful for. And it's kind of like, it's almost like moving my heart, my mind, my body out of this mud, like this sticky, sticky mud. It feels hard to do, but once I just turn my mind to that, it's like, okay, three things I'm grateful for. It's like magic, man. It's like magic. Like after the three things are done, I notice, and being mindful of how I am now, that I don't feel quite so heavy or contracted or yuck anymore. I feel better. You know, our minds are very, very receptive to suggestion. So I'm gonna just offer that as a possible wise response to when you're feeling, the next time you're feeling afflicted. I kind of, when I was thinking about how to talk about afflictive emotions, I was also thinking about Shakespeare for another thing I'm doing. I'm a playwright and I write and direct plays. And Shakespeare, of course, is a big favorite. And it suddenly, I was reminded of, you know, Hamlet, one of the most incredible characters in the Shakespearean canon. Dear Hamlet, dear Hamlet, and his famous speech, to be or not to be, it just kind of reminded me of the situation we're in here when it comes to dealing with life. When things don't go well, when we have difficult, stressful emotions in response to the circumstances of life, and response to ourselves even. So I just wanted to read a little bit of that speech because it seemed so apropos. Okay, we all know it. Many of us probably know it by heart. To be or not to be, Hamlet says, he's in emotional distress. And he says, to be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. So he's got these two, Hamlet, or Shakespeare, can think of like two ways of dealing with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to suffer with it, to suffer with the slings and arrows, or to fight against the slings and arrows, to fight against the difficulties in life. He's got these two options. But Hamlet is a character who's really quite brilliant and understands that neither of those is really sufficient, so then he can only think of like a third option after that, which is to die. To die. If neither of those are the way, to suffer, just be overwhelmed by our suffering, or to fight against it, resist it, or else to die, to sleep, he says, no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. So that's, you know, kind of a bummer, right? It's like this is all that poor Hamlet can think of. Be lost in the suffering, fight against it, or avoid it to the extent of like dying, ending our lives so that we don't have to suffer with the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, which we are, you know? We are. And our emotions are, of course, our human natural response to these thousand natural shocks, but they are difficult. And I think it's interesting, and this is one of the issues I have with art, how art doesn't, at least this particular piece of art, doesn't quite go to, it's like none of those seem like a great option or a great strategy to work with this situation. And this is where the Buddha was so brilliant, because he, in this remarkable insight of his awakening, saw a middle way, another way of dealing with our suffering besides being entangled in it or avoiding or suppressing it. These two sides of the same coin of how we tend to deal with our emotions. And the middle way is neither avoiding nor being entangled in, but it's actually changing our perspective on our emotions, changing the way we view emotions. The middle way is, for those of you who are familiar with the Four Noble Truths, is the fourth noble truth, the eightfold path of practice, which is anchored by what he called wise mindfulness, this practice that we do here of being aware of what's happening when it's happening. And so we turn that capacity to be aware to our experience of emotion, difficult emotion. In a certain way, in a particular way, so that we don't get overwhelmed by it, so that we actually look at it from a perspective where it can free us. Seeing that freeze is the term that I've been using lately, which I stole, totally stole, from Rob Berbea, who's a teacher from England. He has a book called Seeing That Freeze, which I highly recommend. The way that we look at our experience with the attitude that we bring to it and the intention we bring to it is it will reveal itself in such a way that we understand how to work with it now. This is the middle way path of practice. There are eight different steps, and I'll cover a few of them today. But we don't actually have to die to escape our difficult emotions. And we don't have to be lost in them. There is this middle way, which I wanted to explore today. Now, these two sides of the same coin of entanglement in our emotions or avoidance, suppression of our emotions, they tend to be, those are two ways that we, what's called, regulate our emotions. That is, process our emotions, deal with them when they come up. There's two different general, you know, like categories that we have learned over time how to deal with emotions in these two different ways. So, for example, something happens, something happens that upsets us, and we will get sucked into that experience. I was talking earlier about the narrative that goes along with it, that the stuff that happened, that person that did that thing to me, that guy that cut me off on the freeway, you know, what is he trying to do, kill me, you know, whatever. The story, you know, we have these responses, these emotional responses, and a bunch of thoughts that are associated with them, and we get entangled in them. We get entangled, we believe in them utterly. Sometimes the human mind, we have this capacity that's evolved for sampling things. Like we'll sample a little bit, a subset of something out in the environment, and we'll jump to conclusions about what it means. This is a evolved tendency that helps keep us safe, you know, like what's out there and is it dangerous? But say we do that with an expression on someone's face. We see somebody look at us funny with a weird expression, and we jump to maybe the conclusion like, oh, they don't like me, or they didn't like what I just said or did. Oh, that person has a problem with me. And we can sort of proliferate out from that little subset of information into emotions, emotional activation, you know, anger, resentment, hatred of the person even. We can hold grudges sometimes when we don't even have the full information about stuff, you know? Or even if somebody really did something to hurt us, you know, we can, for example, how about this? Here's a good one. You say something angry to someone, or someone says something angry to you, and then for the whole rest of the day you like replay it over and over in your mind. And each time you replay it, you get the hit of the hurt, the anger, the irritation, whatever the response is, each time. And so the entanglement is being lost in that. It's being caught up in that. Replaying like a movie in your head this situation that caused you difficulty, and each time you do, the emotion arises again. That's entanglement. And when we are lost like that, it can easily spiral up out, you know, and we can get activated to and get what's called dysregulated. We can get so, these emotions can be so agitating when we're lost in them like this, when we're entangled in them, what the Buddha called clinging identification, that we can lose our functionality. You know what I mean? Emotions are very agitating to the mind. So when we're angry, it's hard to think straight, right? That's an example of that. So they interfere with our functioning. Emotions do. Fear, I found for myself that fear and anxiety really interferes with my ability to connect with, to make connections, creative connections in my mind, to connect with my heart, to connect with those feelings of compassion, self-compassion and whatnot. There's a lot of ramifications to being entangled. And usually being entangled in a strong emotion is extremely painful, right? And so it's so painful that we will flip then into this, our next, into trying to regulate that strong emotion through avoidance or distraction. So we may flip to the other side of the coin, of this dualistic coin of repressing the emotion. A lot of us have long practiced and habitual tendencies to repress or not feel certain emotions that it wasn't okay to feel, or it's not, we don't think it's okay to feel. That's a form of this type of regulation, avoidance, suppression. We may have a whole list of things that we do to try to distract ourselves. For a long time, my list included alcohol and drug abuse, because that really worked to regulate that, the emotional triggering and suffering. But then it stopped working, of course, caused more. Other forms of distraction, you know, I like to watch TV personally. Anything where we like to shut off our minds, we might flip into. Take a moment to think about your various strategies for avoidance of difficult emotions. Now, I want to point out that some of these may be really skillful. Some of these may actually help to regulate us. For example, it may be in the distraction category, but doing something like exercising, you know, or talking to a friend, co-regulating. We may not be doing the middle way in terms of turning towards the emotion and understanding what it's made of, but we are skillfully bringing ourselves to regulation. That is a nominal range of emotional affect feeling where we can function, where we can come back to feeling okay. And so it's really helpful to develop a whole bunch of those things too. And having a self-soothing meditation practice may be one of those skillful forms of distraction. Instead of paying attention to your emotion, you're turning your attention deliberately to something neutral to bring yourself back to regulation. So some of these are really skillful. Some of them not so much, like getting drunk and using drugs and getting addicted to drugs, and think that's probably not so useful. Some people regulate through blaming the outside world. This is a really popular form of regulation. I feel bad. It's your fault. It's all your fault. If it's your fault, I don't have to feel it. You know, like that. That might not be such a skillful regulation method, because we can cause harm of some. So it's really, that's the measure, is our regulation strategy causing us more harm? Even if it's helping to relieve the pain in the short term, is it actually causing more harm to ourselves and others? That's kind of what we want to look at when it comes to these regulation strategies. So, avoidance, suppression, entanglement, overwhelm, the middle way, which is neither of those. Entanglement, by the way, is what I mean by overwhelm. We get overwhelmed because we're completely lost in and utterly believing in our storyline. That guy did that to me and I'm so pissed. The middle way begins with mindfully recognizing that we are dysregulated or activated, or that there's an emotion going on. That's step one. We have to we have to recognize what's happening when it's happening. So it's this really incredible shift. This is the key to being able to regulate via the middle way. So instead of, oh God, my boss, I hate my boss is so mean to me, my boss so disrespects me, what am I going to do about it? I can't believe my boss said that to me. So disrespectful to, oh, anger. Anger is happening right now. Resentment is happening right now. Irritation, whatever the emotion. Stepping out of completely being, buying into it and saying, this is what's happening right now. That's step one. Okay? You notice that there's this sort of depersonalization that happens when you step out of it being entangled and just say, okay, this is what's happening right now. And it's also not in any way avoiding what's happening. It's simply looking at what's happening from a different perspective, a non-involved perspective, non-identified, at least it's the first step. Okay, anger is happening right now. So then once we recognize what's going on, there's several different things that the Buddha suggested we could do in response to that. We can bring in wise view. We can bring in compassion. We can do some in mindful investigation, clearly see this activated state, this emotion, and try to understand what it is, to let it reveal its nature so we can understand it. And then we can bring, when we bring those in, it's really likely that we might be able to come up with some kind of creative or wise response. Each of those constitutes a wise response to a difficult emotion, rather than being entangled or avoiding it. But also there might be some other thing, you know, in that particular situation that comes to us that we might decide to do. And I'm going to go through each of these by using an example, by offering an example, a story. Oopsie. Pardon me. Are you irritated right now? Recognize irritation? Yeah. You need to get moved. There we go. So my necklace is interfering. One moment, please. Here we go. Okay. Okay, so this is somebody that I've worked with recently, and he has given me total permission to share his story. This is a person who is very fairly new to the practice, only maybe three or four months before of a diligent meditation practice and other Dharma study before he reported this incident to me. And he's a person who self-reports as being like a 0 to 100 anger person, like that, you know? Like something will happen in a relationship or out in the world, and he will get triggered to anger really quickly. He understands that he has, quote unquote, an anger problem or whatever, and that's how he sort of labels it. And that anger, this quick, immediate, very strong anger response is interfering with the kind of person that he wants to be. He wants to be, it's caused him in the past to, you know, leave relationships, to act out in anger, even violently towards people, certainly through verbal abuse and things like that, has caused all kinds of difficulty in his life, and so he wants to work on that so that he can be more, you know, connect with his heart's desire to be more loving and caring and so on. And so I'm just going to tell the end of the story first, and then I'm going to go back to the beginning. The end that he reported to me was that there was a situation which was a typically triggering situation for him with his girlfriend, where something, you know, they moved into a new place together, and she was arranging tchotchkes on the mantelpiece or something, and in some kind of way that he didn't appreciate, asking but not asking for his help, like saying I know you're not interested in where I put the statue or whatever it was, but I think I'm going to put it here or something. And he got triggered into really full-blown anger, and he was at least irritated and then angry as their conversation escalated to be into an argument, a really familiar habit pattern that the two of them would get into. And so he had a moment, because of his meditation practice, he'd been training and recognizing what was happening when it was happening, and he took that mindful shift from being lost in the situation and the anger and the triggering, and recognizing, oh, I'm pissed right now, I'm angry right now. And that helped him to connect with his intention to work with it mindfully. So he decided to experiment with that, and he separated himself from, he just went to the other room, and he practiced with it in the way that he'd been instructed. He practiced with this anger and looked inward, and he observed his body contracted into anger, and he felt the burning sensations in his chest. He felt how uncomfortable it was, how difficult it was to be present with it. He saw his mind running through the story and so on, and he just kept returning his attention to this uncomfortable experience of anger mindfully, and he saw that underneath the anger was hurt. That he had gotten angry because he felt hurt that his girlfriend didn't want to include him or didn't trust him enough to include him in these decisions, and he recognized under the hurt that he actually really wanted to help. He wanted to help make their home together, which was not anything he had ever said to her before. And all of this was new information to him that he understood by being willing to turn toward the anger, recognize it as a mind-body process, and sort of seeing some of the thoughts that were underneath it, some of the assumptions, and so on, and seeing exactly where he was triggered. So out of that clear seeing, which calmed him down quite a bit to see that it was actually he was hurt, he allowed himself to feel hurt, came the idea, probably suggested by one of the teachers he'd been working with, that where he might actually admit this and be vulnerable and tell his girlfriend this. It's like, you know, sort of obvious. This person, it wasn't obvious to do this. He had to go through these mindful steps. So he went back out to his girlfriend and he said that, he said, okay, so I just got really angry and triggered, as you know, and here's why. He just got vulnerable and he admitted what happened. And he said, I'm not blaming you, I'm not putting it on you, but I'm just saying that when you use language like that, it angers me because I feel like you don't want me to be a part of it. Do you want me to be a part of it or whatever? Their conversation then, because women, we really like it when men are vulnerable and honest and open about their feelings. She completely changed her anger, dropped, and they were able to find a more harmonious way forward together, right? And this was like a big moment for both him and their relationship, where they both saw that they could actually work through instead of being stuck in, entangled in this pattern of difficult emotion. And he was the only one who took the middle path. But it only really takes one. And then you can change the conditions that are your dynamic together in such a way that it can move you both forward toward more harmony and less suffering. So he brought in Wise View, which is that the willingness to, you know, the Wise View is stepping out of entanglement and saying, this is happening right now. This is happening. I'm not going to ignore it. I'm not going to act out on it. I'm going to actually instead look at it, open to it, see what it's made of. Wise View is also recognizing that whatever is arising right now is nobody's fault. It's not your fault. It's not my fault. It's arising because of causes and conditions from the past, from the immediate past of somebody having done or said something, or what food you ate for lunch, or how your day is going, to the far past of your own historical conditioning and family life, which is where we develop a lot of these patterns of response and emotional regulation, way far past, to the conditioning of human evolution, of fight or flight. You know, when we feel threatened, we go into these modes of activation. And so none of those are our fault. There may have been a few decisions that we made that were unskillful back in there, but they're over now. We cannot change them because they're in the past. So in a very real sense, what is happening right now, it's blameless. Emotion is blameless. And then we pair that with radical responsibility. That's the other part of Wise View when dealing with emotions. Radical responsibility, which means I am not going to blame you or anything in the outside world for what is happening in my mind and body right now. I'm not going to blame me either. There's going to be no blame. You know, instead, we can experiment with different ways of meeting that difficult emotion, like compassion. Understanding that what's arising right now is conditional and nobody's fault, then self-blame, resentment, judgment, criticism, those are all backfiring strategies of meeting an emotion. A successful strategy I'm offering from personal experience is self-compassion. To move from hating our pain to caring about our pain. And that's like another big shift. Recognize what's happening when it's happening, get out of complete entanglement, and then meet it with care, self-care. So how do we meet it with self-care? The Buddha suggested we turn toward it, and with this heart of compassion and allowance, investigating it, which means to look at it as a mind-body process. See what it's made of, see what its component parts are. I'm going to offer this little bit of information that is also you're going to corroborate in your own practice. Many of you already know this, that every emotion basically has like three component parts. Sensations in the body that are either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Thoughts in the mind, which can take the form of self-talk thoughts, talking, and or imagery, and that's it. That's what an emotion is. And when we look directly at an emotion and observe it, that becomes clear. So we can dismantle, using wise mindfulness, we can dismantle our emotional experience into its component parts, and this really helps with overwhelm. When we see that every emotion is just these waves of sensation through the body, plus some thoughts in the mind that when we believe in, the waves of sensation get stronger, and we see that connection, that understanding frees us from being at the mercy of these emotions, if you will. And it helps us to, just that understanding, it makes it much less personal seeming. I mean, emotions are really feel personal, really feel about me and my stuff and my life and what you did to me. But that's just thoughts that we're believing in. So it's this incredibly freeing way of seeing our emotions, dismantling it into its component parts, mindful investigation, vipassana. And that's what vipassana shows us when we practice it with emotion. And we also see some other very freeing aspects of emotions. We see that they are, as I said, made of component parts, that is, anatta, empty of a concrete self, not me, not mine, and also impermanent, changing. I have read somewhere that a strong emotion lasts for only 90 seconds at the most. We can deal with anything for 90 seconds, right, Hamlet? Come on. But the problem is that we get entangled in the thoughts again, in the storylines, and it drives another wave. So when we're not paying close attention, it feels like it's just this big tsunami of emotion that overwhelms us. But when we look closely, we see that each emotion gets triggered, arises, has these different component parts, it comes through the body in a wave, and then passes. And so we can see, we can actually see them pass, and this helps us to understand that we can be relieved of them. We are relieved of them in that moment. And that they're not like these continuous, solid, torturous things that we think they are. Yeah? Impermanence, anatta. And so then all that information allows us to respond wisely. Like my friend, my student who I told you about. Once we see what this actually is, it frees us up to connect with our hearts and connect with our deepest values. Do we really want to act out of this strong energy in our body of anger or grief? Do we really want to yell or be violent? Is that what our hearts really want? And so in the mindful pause, we can reconnect with our heart's desire for what we really wish for ourselves and our loved ones and everyone around us, you know? And we can experiment with ways to bring us closer to those heart's desires of connection, of harmony, care, and so on. We don't need to be lost in. And then if the habit is too strong, if the energy is too strong, and we do find this intervention, if you will, can happen at any point, whether it is, the Buddha said, before, during, or after a speech or action. We can reflect before, during, or after whether or not this acting out on emotion in this way is going to cause harm or lead away from harm, cause benefit. So even if we have caused some harm yesterday with something unskillful that we said, we can look at it today and recognize that and learn from it and be free of regret and shame and sort of use it as a resolve to maybe practice mindfulness more diligently so maybe we can catch it sooner, that sort of thing. So I wanted to step back and say, go back to my student, my friend, and his story, that this is a training, you know, this is a training. We are slowly learning and training in and developing new beneficial, skillful regulation, emotional regulation habits. We're replacing the unskillful ones of entanglement and avoidance with this middle way, and it takes time. But we start with things that are less high stakes, and we move up to where the rubber hits the road. And so for my friend, before he got to that moment with his girlfriend where he was able to see clearly and respond wisely in that situation of a high stakes relational situation, He had been practicing for some time mindfulness of itching. A teacher suggested to him that a good way of working, we can start to practice working with discomfort, and you know, afflictive emotions are very uncomfortable. We can start working in small ways with discomfort that's a little lower stakes. And so this teacher said to him, like, for example, itching. We can be meditating with itching. We can make the itching our object of meditation. We can pay attention to it. We can look at it. We don't need to scratch the itch. We can watch the mind and body have the impulse to itch without, just watch it happen without doing it, and then see what happens to the itch. We can look at the itch itself and see all the little sensations that make up an itch. We can see that they're impermanent and so on. So when he got this instruction, suddenly he said he was totally afflicted with itching. Like every time he sat down to practice, face itched, body itched, he got plenty of opportunity to practice with the itching. Sometimes he just sat and watched it, watched the itch come, get strong, go away, watched his mind want to itch, but not. And sometimes he actually scratched and felt the relief of that. But what he was learning was this whole new way of relating to discomfort, the middle way of relating to discomfort, neither avoiding it nor being entangled in it, overwhelmed by it. And he saw that it was impermanent, all this. That information immediately and directly related to how he responded to his girlfriend. And he knew that. He was aware of that correlation. Because that's the way he told me the story. He said, I was practicing with itching for a while, and then it occurred to me in an argument with my girlfriend that I could actually apply that lesson to the discomfort of anger. What? Insight, bing, bing, bing. Insight, vipassana insight. So it's really applicable. We can practice in these small ways. And we can slowly and with training and with practice move more toward ease, towards this other option that Hamlet and Shakespeare do not think of. We don't have to avoid, we don't have to be entangled, we don't have to die to work skillfully with and find ease around our afflictive emotions. We just need to practice this middle way. Wise mindfulness, wise view, self-compassion, investigative awareness, self-kindness, mercy, and self-soothing, you know, skillful self-soothing. So I'll end with that. I've talked for quite a long time now. I will end with that. Thank you for your attention.